Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Done my run, coming back from my run, listening to a very interesting podcast about finding some Colombian con man who they can't find. And I look down and he's very good, actually. I don't think they'll ever find him, though. So it's one of those, you get to the end, you're like, I've just gone through 10 episodes and still haven't found him. He's on about his 50th passport now. And I saw a message from you and you said, when it'd be good to record today. So I was kind of thinking, you know, juggling as we're both doing. And I said, well, I could do like in about an hour and then this. And then I got upstairs. I got into the shower, I came out the shower and you went, can you do it now? Wonderfully, you gave me 10 minutes. So you've got a sleeping baby. I've got very wet hair, but I'm pumped.
Yes. I'm not the best planner. So it's more just, now go. Let's do it now. I live in the moment. That's how I would like to describe it. But it was worked out perfectly. So here we are. More tennis has happened.
Yep, here we are. More tennis, tennis never stops, something we established a long, even in the off season, it doesn't stop. And can I tell you that life where I live, as we know in Windsor, never stops because we just had the coronation. Now we've got the horse show.
Of course.
Yeah. I nearly got run over by all the horses. Were they being warmed up, exercised out in the parks? And nearly got squashed by one of those. And everything's still being packed away from the coronation because we had the big. So obviously the coronation was in London, nothing to do with us. But then we had the big pick. We had the big concert. Did you watch the concert on Sunday night? Did you watch it?
Yeah, looks like a lot of fun.
Do you like it? Did it look good? Windsor look
good? Yeah, all of it was. Windsor always looks good. It's got a mega castle in it.
Yeah, big castle.
And some good uplighting as well. So
really good uplighting. Great uplighting.
So it looks pretty smart.
We had friends down, so we thought, oh, well, we should go along to give them some Windsor experience. But it was really muddy. It had been raining. And everyone's like, oh, it's going to be a washout. Yeah. So we were kind of trudging through the mud thing. And I was thinking, how long is acceptable before I say to our friends, why don't we just go? Why don't we just leave this kind of muddy kind of festival pit? And then this security guy appeared and said, could you please stand there? And I thought, well, this is slightly right. I was literally in the middle of a field. It was a busy field, but a field. And so we stood there. And the next thing, the Prince and Princess of Wales are walking along this makeshift path that we're kind of either side of.
There you go.
And so I had the children in front. Obviously, one of the twins, he's older but shorter, looks kind of cute and little, but he's obviously older. And bigger than he looks, older he looks. And suddenly, Princess of Wales stops and starts having a chat with him.
Oh, wow. All these years of living in Windsor, finally.
She picked the shyer of the two. So my other one shook the Prince of Wales' hands, was kind of chatty. But the little one, she bent down. She was fully bent down. There's sort of all these TV cameras around. So my eldest was a bit kind of like, oh. So she's like, what's your name? And then she's like, are you enjoying your day? Have you had an ice cream? And he kept shaking his head. And I was like, stop shaking your head. So she's like, well, have a nice day and I hope you get an ice cream soon. So basically his takeaway was, he wasn't that interested because she wasn't a footballer and he's big on football. And secondly, he was like, that lady said, you've got to buy me an ice cream.
There you go. Like, and she seems important. So there you go. Got to listen to her. I'll be so fascinated to hear what the coronation was like for international listeners. Like, did it register at all? I imagine it registered in various places around the world. It's a pretty big deal. But obviously we're British and just sort of in amongst it all. We had a street party, which was fun.
Did you?
I mean,
oh, did you?
Any excuse for a street party. Yeah, it's great.
Was it a good street party?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Everybody came out, all the kids. We did it on the Sunday, so it was better weather. Yeah. That was important because the Saturday was a washout. Would not have been a fun street party. But yeah, I did it on Sunday and it was, it was fab. But I am interested to see what people think from around the world because it's obviously, like, we've never seen a coronation before either. So it's new for us. I think sometimes people think because we're British, we sort of
watch them all the time.
You know, we live and breathe it, and we know it. We know, like, we know it inside out. But you know, it's all a bit of a novelty, really.
Did you watch it? Did you watch the actual coronation?
I did. Yeah. I mean, not all of it. I mean, it's ultimately a church service, a fairly lengthy one. Which there's very nothing wrong with that. It's just, you know, it's not. Yeah, there's just some slightly different elements. A church service, pop a crown on his head. That was about the general gist of it. Lots of singing.
As we saw, they had a little bit of trouble. They were kind of screwing the crown on his head at one point.
I think they're very heavy.
I was like, what? Yeah.
Very heavy.
I think they were watching a rerun of the Football World Cup final, Argentina-France, for the, we're into triple figures now. And I just said, look, boys, I think we should put it on. And they were like, why? And I said, just because it's sort of a historical, I say we're not royalists, but it's a big moment. So I thought, just have it on, have a little look, because the Brits do things like that very well. The sort of the ceremony, the outfits, the everything. And I was like, just have a little look, because it'll probably come up in class. People will talk about it. So they just had a little watch, and they said, Mummy, is it done now? can we switch it off now? So we had a little bit of it.
Yeah. And as I say, it was sort of predominantly a church service, which is completely fine if you want to sit and watch church service for an hour and a half or however long it was. So it wasn't too dramatic. I think it was everything else, wasn't it? It was the parade, the procession, the hip hip hoorays. I think everything around the actual coronation bit was the concert, you know, all that sort of stuff was definitely much more fun. But yeah, it was good. It was a nice weekend. Loads of bank holidays in May. Yeah. Can't complain.
Yes, we had another one here in the UK. Another bank holiday on that Monday. Our street had a kind of impromptu street party on the Monday. It wasn't huge. I was actually working on the Monday, but it was a little gathering. But no, it was nice. But now, so we've got it's called the Royal Windsor Horse Show, which is kind of taken over, I think, for the next 4 or 5 days. And then I think Windsor will just go back to, I guess being Windsor. But in amongst all the kind of coronation and the bank holidays and children not going to school, the tennis, well, in terms of what we talked about last week, we were talking about Emma Raducanu, and would it be maybe a good idea for her maybe to sit out the clay then come back later? As it turns out, I think a few hours after we recorded, she's going to be sitting out a lot longer with a total of 3 operations she's having.
Oof. Oh, it was horrible news, isn't it? Really devastating. Yeah. I mean, I suppose positive because it potentially could put an end to all of the niggles and all of the difficulties that we've seen from her. But I mean, it is tough to be having operations this early in your career with very little playing been done. It's not like, you know, because you wear out your joints and your bones, and you know, that's what happens. I mean, as we see, you know, somebody like Andy and, you know, Nadal just taping themselves together just to get on the court when they get older. But, you know, that just shouldn't be the case when you're young. And it, you know, this is, you know, surgical intervention, and it can sometimes, you know, lead you down a path that can be really difficult. It's not guaranteed to sort it out. It could sort it out, but then cause other problems. It's the ankle one I'm sort of less concerned about, because ankles are ankles.
Sorry, insight. Thank you for that insightful comment.
No, it's like, the big problems, you know, if you're a tennis player, probably the biggest area that you don't want to have impacted is the wrist, because we have seen how devastating it is for players. Look at Dominic Thiem right now. He's having to rework his entire game, his entire technique to try and come back from that issue. Look at somebody like Laura Robson, the Brit. She had an operation on both wrists, never really returned fully. You know, that was really difficult for her. And yeah, so both wrists are being operated on for Emma. That, you know, that's pretty significant, pretty serious, and it's concerning, because there's no guarantee it's going to sort it out. That's the trouble.
Because that's the, I mean, everyone will know this anyway, but that's what absorbs all the shock. That takes the brunt of all the force. And when you imagine the balls you're hitting, whether it's in practice or match situations, that wrist has to hold firm. It's the apex of the force that's flying through your hand and arm.
Yeah, it's also about, like, the looseness of the wrist as well. Like, you have to really fling it about. You need lots of lag. You know, if you freeze frame the positions that the wrist goes into, it looks a bit weird. Sometimes I look at it. I remember looking at a picture of myself hitting a shot and with my wrist at a funny angle. And I was like, I don't think I can physically put my wrist in that position. How does that happen? So it is very much an area that you don't really want to mess around with. But I mean, she clearly doesn't have a choice. So fingers crossed, she's able to recover, that the surgery's successful and she's able to play again. But she will have to completely start over again. I was talking last week about how having time off is an issue, and especially when you have time off, play a little bit more time off, more time off, it just really compounds. And this is going to be a big block off for her, so it will be completely starting again.
Yeah, because someone was talking to me about it and they said, do you think it means she can come back with less pressure on her? And I said, I don't think she will ever have less pressure on her. She is Emma Raducanu. From what she did and then all the other bits she did around it, she's a superstar. You know, the other pressure now will be, can she get back there? That will be the spotlight. You know, the spotlight's been, can she match what she did at the US Open? Can she hold on to that ranking? Can she stay in the top 100? Can she this and that? There's never going to be a case where, you might think it's wrong but or different, but I don't think there'll ever be a time when Emma Raducanu can play pressure free, because the next set of pressure is she able to come back from this?
Yeah, that's it. It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, look, pressure is ultimately what you put on yourself. It's how you digest everything that is going on. But we've said it so many times, it's just so weird that everything's happened backwards. It's, you know, really the pressure should be on the players that haven't quite won a slam. Somebody like an Ons should be, if we really think about it, she should be feeling the utmost amount of pressure, because she could possibly finish her career without winning a Grand Slam. And that would, you know, that would be a disappointment to her, because that's the goal, right? You know, she wants to win a slam. She wants to win Wimbledon. She's been in finals. And, you know, but once you've done that, and that's what Emma was saying, and she said it so many times, she's like, I've literally won a slam. Like, why is there pressure? I've done it. I've done it. The thing that everybody desperately wants to do, remember the amount of pressure on Andy before winning a slam or before winning Wimbledon, just the desperation of wanting to do it. And she's like, but I've done it. Like, box ticked, mission complete. You know, sort of like an Ash Barty mentality. She's like, yeah, I've done it. Cool. Checking out. Thanks. Yeah, I'm off. I completed the game. So you feel like there shouldn't really be any pressure, but there's just so, so much attention. And it's amazing, isn't it, that she can win the US Open. And the most common question, even within the world of tennis, even when I was talking to press, talking to coaches, talking to media, anyone within the world of tennis, as soon as she won that US Open, the question was, yeah, but is she the real deal? And it's like, but she literally just won a slam. I don't quite, what is that as a question? Or would you mean the real deal? How is winning a slam not the real deal? I don't understand. Like, it's so bizarre. There will always be something, you know. Like, you know, Andy's won his few slams, but, you know, no, he hasn't won 20 plus slams like the others. Does that make him not the real deal? What's the real deal? I don't know. Is Federer not the real deal because he doesn't have more? Like, do you know what I mean? It's so, there's just always another level. Yeah. And I mean, it's amazing that literally within hours of her winning that slam, people go, well, is she the real deal? I mean, what more evidence do you need? She's won a slam at 19. But it doesn't matter. But also, it doesn't matter if she doesn't win a match ever again. She's the real deal because she's a Grand Slam champion. Do you know what I mean? It's so bizarre. Yeah.
And she came through qualifying. She did not drop a set. She is the real deal. She beat everyone and everything that was put before her. So, yes, she is. And I think the other thing is mentally, I guess this is more from the athlete's point of view, is having the confidence in the wrists again. I remember Nishikori came back, had wrist surgery, and I remember it was at Monte Carlo, and he was talking about it. He said, my doctor and trainer have both said, I cannot do damage to my wrist. It's fine. It's absolutely fine. He said, but mentally for me, I was nervous. I was nervous about that force going through my wrist, even though he'd been told by everybody around him, it's fine, you're fine, it's healed. And I've seen that with footballers who've had hamstring problems. They don't want to extend themselves to the max. They're worried it will go again. And Dominic Thiem having the faith in his wrist again, Juan Martín Del Potro. So I imagine, and maybe it's a youth thing again, she's young enough for that to be fine. And I don't know in terms of injuries you had at different levels, but it's having that belief that it's fine and you can give it everything and not do it damage.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that as long as it takes to rehab it physically back to 100%, it then takes the same time again to get the confidence back. So you sort of have to do double rehab. You have to get it back up in action and then you've got to start learning to trust it again. But it's incredibly difficult. And as I say, with wrists, you really are just giving everything you can in such a loose way and slightly out of control. That's the thing, it's the difference between the wrist and the ankle. You know, an ankle, you know, you're sort of in control of it all of the time. Unless you roll your ankle, then you're not in control of it. But you're sort of, that sort of movement, that hyperextension, if you roll your ankle, if you go over on it, that's sort of what you're doing to your wrist on every single shot. Is you're stretching, you're sort of flicking it around, and that's the lack of control. And now look, you can roll your ankle and not sprain it at all. I do it all the time. You know, and people go over on their ankles, they get up and they're fine and they carry on. Sometimes it can look really, really nasty. But, you know, imagine you're having to do that to your wrist on every single shot. It's, you know, it's a little bit scary. You know, you do feel vulnerable, but as I say, because you just don't have the control and it's going at such high speed that, you know, once you commit to the shot, you're committed. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. To find that level of commitment again, even if you're just off by 1%, you know, it'll never be what it was, really. So I don't know. Yeah, it's just, I mean, look, it's tough, isn't it? It's really tough for her. She was clearly in a foul mood in Madrid, as we were talking about last week, and this is the reason why. She knew her clay court season and grass court season was over. She's probably less bothered about the clay, but more bothered about the grass. You know, an opportunity to play at Wimbledon gone. I mean, you only get a certain amount of years. Say you play at Wimbledon 10-15. Mm-hmm. You could have a 15-year career. You only get to play there 15 times. And this would have been her third time. So you sort of, it ticks away. And all of the work, I think if I was in her position, I think the hardest thing would be that all of the work that's been done over the past year, and whilst there haven't been the results, there has been the work and her game has started to grow. It's really just gone. All for nothing, to be honest.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
But you mentioned Madrid in there, so that was the headline, especially from a British point of view at the beginning. Do you want, by the end, we have different headlines swirling around. Do you want to start with the tennis, the actual tennis that was played and who won, or do you want to start with the controversy at the end of the women's doubles final?
Let's start with the tennis. Let's start with the who won. I mean, look, Alcaraz defending a Masters title at his age is just, you know, it's huge. You know, his home country, the works. You know, I was just thinking, do you think people are asking, is he the real deal, Carlos Alcaraz?
There will be someone.
I was just about to go,
Carlos Alcaraz, the real deal.
I was just about to be like, look, he's defended Masters titles. He's the real deal. He's a slam champion, world number one. People are going, is he the real deal, though? Oh, my God. But
there will be someone.
What's the tipping point? I don't understand. What's the tipping point of being the real deal? That's what I want to know.
I would say, in general, I'm not saying this is my thing, but I would say in general, it's probably multiple Grand Slam. I think if you win more than one Grand Slam title, I don't think anyone can question if you're the real deal, because you've actually backed up the best thing that you can achieve in tennis. I'm not saying that's my barometer, but I could see that being many people's barometer.
Yeah, okay, understood. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yes, but no, amazing performance from him. Yeah. It's just so much fun to watch him play, taking the game to new levels. We'll continue to see it. He's the real deal, guys. That was great. I don't know. What did you think? For me, that felt like almost as big, not necessarily as big as winning a slam, but it felt like a huge moment for him to defend a Masters title like that. I think is pretty mega.
Yeah, absolutely, and he did it with such style. It wasn't easy, even in the final against Jan Lennard Struff. And a word to Jan Lennard Struff, whose ranking as a result of that had shot back up, and it was so nice to see him playing like that. And you can also, what about Aslan Karatsev? Where's he been? He appeared, disappeared, popped back up again. Borna Coric, the run he had. I mean, we know what Coric can do and has done on the past in clay, but just so that I think there were some lovely stories through that. But for Carlos Alcaraz, I was about to say, here's the real deal. I've got to stop saying that. It's the way he's come back from injury, the way he's handled everything since winning the US Open and being number one, and he's likely to go back to being number one. The way he handles everything, that's what I love about Alcaraz. It's always with a smile. And he has no less pressure than anyone else because he's had the pressure of every press conference he went in his early stages of being compared to one of the greatest tennis players there's ever been. So every time he went in, oh, you like him, you act like him, do you want to be like him, do you want to emulate him, can you be as good as him? So he had that pressure. He wins a Grand Slam title. We know players react very differently to that. He got the world number ranking. He was then injured, but he's done it all with a smile. He seems, what I love about Alcaraz, and to a state, Iga Świątek is they thrive on that pressure. They like it. They want it. And they grow from it. He looks so relaxed. He looks so good. I mean, it's frightening. If you're in a draw with him, I think it's at the moment, I was looking at the Rome draw when it came out, I think you're more frightened to be in Alcaraz's section than you are in Djokovic's. That'd be right? That'd be fair?
I think, yeah, based on the level that they're playing, I think that's fair. I think it depends at which stage you're playing them. I think if you're in a final, you're taking on Djokovic, you're probably feeling like you've got less chance than you have against Alcaraz, even though Alcaraz is probably playing the better tennis right now. Well, he is playing the better tennis right now. It's just because, you know, the latter stages of a tournament, Djokovic just knows how to find it really from nowhere. And maybe Alcaraz is that little bit more inexperienced. But yeah, it's great. I can't wait. What we want is Alcaraz, Djokovic, Grand Slam finals and Masters finals. That's what we want.
But on who you're most afraid of, who's coming into form. Nadal, we now know, have played a warm-up event. Do you hold it? Yeah, we can say it's Roland Garros, it's Philippe Chatrier, it's best of five sets, etc., etc. But where are you now with Nadal going into the French?
Yeah, this isn't like that time when it was held in October and it was, everybody was talking about this.
It was really cold.
Yeah, this isn't people trying to cling on to the tiny percentages that might make a difference and that means that Nadal doesn't play very well, which is what we had in that October one. This is about the guy hasn't played. He hasn't played. And I think that it is highly unlikely that he would play with no warm-up tournaments. It's one thing, last year he played very, very injured. Very, very injured. But, you know, he was sort of playing. He was just playing very, very injured. And as you say, this would be the first time, no warm-up events. I mean, does he want to turn up and potentially go out in the first round? Who knows? But, I mean, what he did last year was absolutely bonkers on one foot.
I can't imagine him not being there, even with no tournaments, because surely there must be something in him thinking, but it's best of five and it's Roland Garros and there's something about, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm in that kind of fairy tale world of Nadal at Roland Garros. I can't imagine him not being there. If he is fit, I know he hasn't played any, but if he's physically able to be there, despite not having played in recent weeks and months, I just can't imagine him not being there.
I know, it's weird, isn't it? I sort of can imagine him not being there. But I can't comprehend how painful that would be for him. Can you imagine being at home if you want to die? I mean, it's like it's his tournament. They should rename it. It's the Nadal Cup. That's what it is.
It's his birthday there. It's everything about that tournament screams. Yeah. Screams him. Screams.
Well, you know,
his name.
Do you remember? What, do you? Sorry, do you remember back in 1910? do you remember?
Yeah, no.
No, not do you remember? Do you remember the fact that, and people might not remember this or might not know it at all, that I know at Wimbledon anyway, I'm not sure about the other slams, but at Wimbledon it was the winner of each year would just turn up for the final and everybody else would battle it out. and you they would just turn up for the final. And
I love that.
You just won match. But that's basically what Nadal has done. As in, he's just been guaranteed to be in the... It is about, can you beat Nadal to win this tournament? That's just it, period. And not many people have. But it has just felt like that. It's like, well, yeah, he's a banker. And you go, feel sorry for everybody in his entire half of the draw. The 63 players in Nadal's half of the draw. That's your Roland Garros title dreams over. And then there he is. He sort of walks his way to the final, winning like 1-2 and 1 in the quarters against top 10 opponents and absolute nonsense. And it feels like, I don't know. Can you win Wimbledon? Can you win Roland Garros without a Nadal in there? Does it feel like you've won Roland Garros if Nadal's not in, even in the tournament? Of course it does. Of course I'm being silly. Look, his
people in the past who have won Roland Garros, it's like, oh, they won Roland Garros, but Rafa Nadal wasn't there. But that was at a different time when Rafa Nadal wasn't beaten up, bruised, and his body completely battered. But it's
it has to come to an end at some point.
Yeah,
it is absolutely phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. It's better than anything that's been achieved in tennis. It's got to be up there with one of the biggest achievements in sport, period, of anyone ever. It is absolutely ludicrous. A lot of people say that it's the toughest challenge in sport, Nadal on Chatrier. It's just, do you know what I'll miss this year if he doesn't play? It's just looking at the face on the opponent that walks onto Chatrier against him. Because the noise, and you know it, the noise when Nadal walks onto Chatrier, I mean, he might as well be French. It's just absolutely... oh my God, could you imagine if he was French as well? Could you even imagine? They'd lose their minds. But yeah, there's the noise and the look on the face of the opponent because they walk out first and then the camera's always on the Nadal when he walks on for his eruption in the crowd. And no, if you're on site, you can take a little look. And they always do just have a little bit of a jolt, a little bit of a look because it is so loud.
No, but you know what it is? It's the moment, right? You're playing Nadal on Chatrier. So it's the first round. You've got through. You can't believe it. You're a bit scared. Your legs don't move. Your arms feel heavy. And then the MC introduces both the players and you have his number, whatever he's done this. He's a lovely man. He lives with his mum and he's a great fella. And then you go on to Nadal. Once you've got through everything, he then does every year of every title he's won.
It's so good.
And there's a cheer after every title. And you're down the other end thinking, my legs felt like lead. I now can't move. And if you didn't really, really know what you're up against, once they finally got through all the titles, you're like, yeah, and that was only the titles at Roland Garros. Yeah. I mean, it's
so good, isn't it?
It's special, isn't it?
It's absolutely so special. Cool. I just laugh every time because it is so ludicrous.
it's just so long every single year.
I remember, you know, watching the episodes in Breakpoint around Roland Garros. So you had Casper Ruud against him, and it was also, well, Ruud was the final, but before that was Auger-Aliassime. And you could just see, I think anybody watching that could see that Nadal had won those matches before he walked on court.
100%.
Just the intensity of him in the locker room. And I just found it so fascinating talking to Ben and to other people who don't know about the workings on. They're like, why are they always waiting for him? And I'm like, because that's how it works. They pick up the lower ranked player first, you then go to the changing room, and you know, he's not called until you're standing outside. So then he's going to make you wait. And then, you know, so you have to wait. But it was just amazing how they just looked so intimidated. So intimidated. And look, that is... And everybody watches that and goes, well, why don't they just give it back? Just do it back, you know, because, you know, Nadal's sprinting and bunny hopping and doing all this stuff and high-fiving all of his team. And you can see how locked in he is and any hope of him not playing well, because that's what you're going to have, right? You're taking on Nadal and you're ranked 7 in the world on Chatrier, right? The first thing you're thinking is, well, you know, if he's not at his best, then I can maybe do this and get in and be competitive. And this is that, that's what you're clinging on to. And what he's doing with all of that pre-match stuff behind the scenes is making a statement to his opponent that he is 100% locked in, he's not taking anything for granted, and that the chances of him not playing his best are very, very low. Or not his best, but, you know, well enough. It's very, very low, probably zero. And that is what you can see just sort of drain out of them. Like, just the, any sort of belief is gone, because you're just looking at him going, he is taking this match more seriously than I've ever taken anything in my life.
And the longer the tournament goes on, the less chance you have. And it shouldn't work like that, because the longer tournament goes on, the higher ranked player you probably are going to be facing Nadal. And if you've got very little hope in the first round when you're, I don't know, 57 in the world, it doesn't mean that someone who's 2, 3, 4 in the world is going to have, or 1 in the world is going to have any more hope, because when you get to the final, you know that Nadal, with the problems he was facing last year, couldn't feel his foot, all the thing. He knows it's one more match. He knows he's just got to put himself through one more match in his backyard to get another title. And so it's crazy that you have even less hope, even if you go out there as a very good established player in your own right. You just, as you say, the look on Casper Ruud's face, you're like, oh, it's not going to end well.
I think one of the things that we've learnt from Rafa, especially last year with what he did at the French, and then of course he had to pull out at Wimbledon. I can't remember what round it was, but anyway. But I think if he takes to the court, he believes he can win.
Yeah. Yes.
So I think, yes, we just have to trust him on that. He's not going to turn up, no, play and just lose 2-2 and 2 because he can't move. If he's walking on that court, he believes that there is a way to win. And if there's a way to win, annoyingly for his opponents, he tends to find it. And, you know, and then at Wimbledon, he pushed it as far as he could, and he just got to the stage where he was just like, I cannot win this match. It's not happening. I'm not going to play anymore. And so I think we've got to trust him. If he turns up to Roland Garros and if he walks on that court in round one, I think the whole tournament better be scared, because he's, I think particularly with Roland Garros, I don't think it's even about winning. Maybe he would take it round by round, but if he doesn't think there's a chance of him winning that first round, I don't think he will walk on the court. So if he's walking on the court, he's done something. He's stitched himself up. He's had a leg transplant. I don't know what he's done, but he's going to make it happen.
A couple of people we expect to be walking out at Roland Garros faced off against each other in the final of Madrid, while we're still on Madrid, with Sabalenka coming through 6-3 in the third against Swiatek. I watched the final. I enjoyed the final. I was happy for Sabalenka, to kind of break that mental block against Swiatek. I like them as a pair coming up against each other. And I like the fact that Sabalenka, I know she went out super early in Rome, but I like the fact that Sabalenka has carried on from the Australian Open and she's kept some momentum.
Yeah, I think, look, Swiatek is going to be the consistent force, probably the world number one for a long time to come. She's made it perfectly clear now, this is a full 12 months of her being ludicrously consistent at the top of the game. But I think that other players in that top 10, with the experience that they have now, are going to start beating her more and more frequently. So we are going to see a lot more sort of runner-up plates from Swiatek. She's always going to be operating at that back end of the tournament. But the likes of Sabalenka, I could put Jabeur in there, but I sort of fancy the bigger hitters a bit more. Rybakina, those sorts of players, we have seen them overwhelm her. Pegula, maybe. It can happen. I think they've got an awful lot more belief than they had this time last year, where they were just all looking at each other going, any ideas? Anyone? No? We'll just go lose 1-1, shall we? So I think that we're going to see, as I say, Swiatek's going to be the one to beat, but she's going to get beaten by those real challenges. Look, she's going to make a statement and go, you're going to have to be world class, a big hitter, and you're going to have to do it to a world class level to beat me. But they can now. That's the difference. And I think they know what they're doing. They've sussed it out a little bit. So it's going to be really fascinating, I think, particularly back end of slams now. I see Swiatek going, more very consistently deep in events. It's always a bit of a shock when she loses early at all. Yeah. Whereas the others, it's a bit more, you can see them going out early. It's a bit more hit and miss with what they're able to deliver. It's still relatively consistent, don't get me wrong. I mean, Sabalenka, as you say, she's backed stuff up. She is playing much more consistently than she has done before and is achieving a lot more. But, you could see her crashing out in a first or second round just here and there. And, it's fine. It's sort of what you get with her. So, that's sort of how I see it panning out the rest of the year.
And that's what we got with Sabalenka in Rome. Pegula lost early in Rome as well. And Pegula links us back. We're sort of flip-flopping Madrid, Rome as we speak. It's early stages Rome, back to Madrid, because Pegula was involved in the women's doubles final top seed with Coco Gauff. They lost out to Beatrice Haddad-Meyer and Victoria Azarenka. Azarenka and Haddad-Meyer actually comfortably won that in straight sets. But it was what followed, or what should have followed but didn't follow, that caused the problems and has led to the Madrid tournament offering an apology.
Yes, it was a fascinating one, wasn't it? I didn't quite know what was going on. Not very nice for people not to be allowed to speak after winning a title, as we had. Yeah, don't really know why. Don't really know, what they were thinking, really. And of course there was going to be significant backlash. I don't know why the tournament were surprised by that. And yeah, they're going to look at their protocols. I know that there's different things to navigate and, you know, politically and that sort of thing. But, you know, look, if players are playing a tournament, they've got a chance of winning. And if they've got a chance of winning, then they get to do everything that comes with that. Or coming runner up, as it is. So, you know, whoever's in the tournament, you win. That's the point of getting to the final. You get that ceremony, you get the chance to thank people. And it was so sweet that Coco Gauff was thanking everybody on Twitter, because even though she's won loads of titles and been in huge amounts of finals, especially her and Pegula, she's like, no, again, this week I want to thank people. I want to, you know, that's what she does.
Well, it's a lot of people that puts this together, isn't it? Yeah, it's the people on court who are taking the prizes, but it's the coaches, it's the family, it's the friends, it's sponsors, it's everyone who makes it possible. And that's the opportunity. And for some, they win titles all the time. But as you said, Gauff still wanted to say thank you. For others, winning titles isn't something they do all the time. They haven't done for a while. Victoria Azarenka, in her case, you know, her son, Leo, is now of an age, really of an age now, where he gets it. Do you know what I mean? When he's a baby, and you say, oh, I thank my children. They're like looking at you, like waving their arms, thinking what's going on. But it's your moment. And look, that's a really good win over Pegula and Gauff. I had Admire and Azarenka. It's your moment. And they didn't get their moment. And Pegula and Azarenka, they're all asked about it. As you said, Madrid have come out and apologised. They said they're going to rethink things. And the other thing that people saw a discrepancy in was Sabalenka and Alcaraz both had their birthdays. And Alcaraz had this sort of, it's like a wedding cake. It's as big as a wedding cake.
It was, yeah.
Given to, oh, it was enormous. He's an athlete. He's not going to eat it on court. And Sabalenka had one tier of a wedding cake sort of in the locker room. And it's just sort of, you know, come on, guys, we've got to, let's make two wedding cakes or just two little one tier things. We're both at this tournament. We're both at an equal level. We're both at whatever, as you say, politically things come into it. But let's just, if you're going to give one, give the same to the other. You know, if you're going to give a microphone to the men's doubles, as you always would, give it to the women. So I think it's understandable that the players were asked about it and weren't happy about it. But as I say, Madrid have come up with a statement. And I think it's safe to say that in Rome, probably everyone's going to have a little speech after their wins.
yeah, probably. Although Rome doesn't have the best record at that sort of stuff, to be fair. You know,
they're going to be exemplary this year. They're going to be perfect.
Well, yeah. And that is the difference, say, between somewhere like Madrid and Rome. Okay, everybody's getting hung up on the cakes and the speeches and stuff. And I understand. I think it was a bit silly on their part. I'm not particularly angry about it, but it just was a bit like, oh, come on. Like, this is a bit silly. There's no need. But Madrid has equal prize money. Rome does not. By a long shot. There's a massive, massive difference. And if you're a ticket holder and you pay your, I don't know how much it is, you pay your 50 euros, 60 euros, I don't know how much it is, to go, you will see men's tennis and you will see women's tennis, and they will not be receiving anywhere close to the same amount of money. Yeah. They will both be playing best of three sets. And, you know, that is, for me, a much bigger situation than a cake. Or a speech.
Yeah,
and that's where I do feel a little bit for Madrid, because there are a huge amount of tournaments that don't have equal prize money. A lot of Masters events, 1000s for the women's, that don't have equal prize money. It's not just Rome. And so Madrid is one of the ones that does. And yeah, they've made a couple of silly mistakes. There's comments about the models as ball girls as well. And that's always been a historical thing in Madrid. But, you know, all of that stuff, I think personally, is not really that important in comparison to paying people the same amount.
And on that note, with your baby about to wake up, and I was told by my children this morning that the fridge and the cupboards were empty, and can I go out and buy some food? And I was like,
come on.
I was like,
come on, Mum.
I was like, okay. And one of mine, despite their young age, is a massive Eurovision fan. He watched a bit.
Oh, fun.
I don't know where it comes from. I think he caught a bit of it last year, and I think it meant he could stay up late. So I think he, he equates Eurovision Song Contest with not going to bed. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So now he's like, Mum, we've got to watch the Eurovision Song Contest. I'm like, do we really? So I've got to go and get some food and because soon it'll be off to France, Roland Garros. So the mum guilt is kicking in early. So I'm going to get some food. We're going to watch the Eurovision and have a bit of a thing.
Oh, that'll be fun. We'll enjoy. And feed your children.
No, yeah. Primarily, I've got to go and buy some food to feed my children. But it was lovely. And I'll speak to you again.